Thank you. So I'm going to report on a recent joint work with Sébastien Bouxon, Philippe Etidieu, and Ahmed Zeriahi on solving Monge-Ampère equations with respect to a given big cohomology class. So before doing this, I will first recall the classical case of Keller classes. So in all the talk, X will be compact Keller manifold of dimension n, and let me perhaps start by recalling results due to Aubin and Yao in the 70s, which says that if the first chain class of X is negative, then there exists a unique Keller form T in alpha, which is a Keller-Einstein metric. Oh, sorry, so alpha here is minus T1 of X. So that is to say that the Ricci form of T is equal to minus. So maybe I should recall that if Keller form is locally given like this, then the Ricci form of omega is the sum of minus Vd bar of the log of the determinant of Gij bar. So there is some normalizing constant here. This is the Ricci form of omega. And it is well known that this is a closed one-on form that represents the first chain class. So when omega, if you start with some omega that belongs to minus T1 of X, then Ricci of omega and omega are cohomologous. So you can write Ricci of omega equals minus omega plus VDC of some smooth function. And solving this equation then boils down to solve the following Monge-Ampère equation. So finding T of this form in alpha such that Ricci of T is minus T is equivalent to solve the Monge-Ampère equation Monge-Ampère of phi to the n equals e to the phi e to the h omega omega to the n. So that's the setting of Aubin and Yao's result. And the problem I would like to address now is what can be said if, rather than assuming that the first chain class is negative, which means, which is equivalent to say that the canonical bundle is ample, what happens if the canonical bundle is merely big? That was a bad idea. So there are at least two natural approaches to this question, to solve this problem. The first one, goes like this. First you try to find a better model than X. So that the corresponding canonical bundle is ample. And actually, you can do that. It's a quite recent and fundamental result. But then you have to allow X-CAN to have mild so-called canonical singularities. And once you have found such a model, then you try to solve the corresponding Mangenpère equation. Which are now slightly degenerate due to the singularities of X-CAN. And this is doable. And this is actually a recent result of ACDE, myself and Zeriai, which is to appear in JAMS. So one natural question that we had in mind is it possible to actually redo the same thing without knowing for the existence of the canonical model? Sorry? That? With the, I mean, the existence of the canonical model was not. Yeah? Okay. So, second approach that I would like to discuss is I would like to try to do the same thing directly without knowing for the existence of the canonical model. And there are actually several other motivations to do that, not only to obtain this kind of result that way. So this is the main subject of my talk now. But before starting, we'll make a few comments. The first one is that Yao has actually proved a more powerful result than solving this Mangenpère equation. He has solved what you could call flat Mangenpère equations. Which are of the following form. So I will denote them by a double star. And here, it actually works when the class alpha, the class of omega, is any scalar class. And the measure mu is any volume form. But you need a normalizing condition that the total mass of the measure on the right has to be the same as the one on the left, which means that the measure, the total mass of mu, has to be equal to the volume of the class alpha. So it turns out that those flat equations are more difficult to study, but they're also more powerful than the simple star one, namely a simple fixed point argument shows that if you know how to solve double star, then you know how to solve a simple star. So in the sequel, I will actually concentrate on this type of equation, so these flat equations, but now the class I would like to consider is merely big rather than being Keller. The second comment is that it has been studied in recent years what can happen if the measure that you have on the right-hand side is less regular than a volume form. And I would like to mention a fundamental result of Kolodziej that says that you can solve, this is in the late 90s, can solve double star when mu is a measure with density in LP, be bigger, strictly bigger than 1. And then the output is a unique solution, normalized solution, which is continuous. So it's no more smooth, you cannot expect smoothness, but it is at least continuous solution. And it turns out a recent result of Kolodziej is that the solution is actually Hölder continuous, that you cannot do more than that. And even more singular measures can be handled. So this is a recent result of mine and Tergiai, which plays an important role in the sequel, that you can solve double star when the measure mu is what we call non-pluripolar, meaning that it puts no mass on a pluripolar set. And in this case, there is also a unique solution, but the solution phi has what we call finite energy. So I will define what finite energy means in a few minutes. It turns out that finite energy guys are the right, is the finite energy class is the right class to look at in order to understand the volume of a given cohomology class. So it's actually not only for the pleasure of generalizing things to more degenerate situation, methodology, but it's also a quite practical way of solving Monge-Ampère equations that are with reasonably smooth solutions. So the methodology is like this when, say, the class is big. We try first to solve the flat Monge-Ampère equation in the class of finite energy. In a sense, we first construct a unique, weak solution. And as you will see in a few minutes, it turns out to be reasonably easy to do that. And then we have a unique solution. And then you try to establish a priori estimates. The second step is the more regular the measure mu, the more regular the solution is. If you try to do directly, to construct directly a smooth phase solution, you are forced to work with classes that are moving. So the natural strategy will be to say that the class is big, if you don't know how to solve Monge-Pascal equations there, so you would try to approximate it by scalar forms in a certain sense, in some blow-up, and then to try to pass to the limit. And if you try to do that at once with a priori estimates, it will be technically extremely difficult because you will have to move the class at the same time as you want to have the uniform estimate. In order to motivate this, let me mention a widely open case when the first term class is instead positive, so the case of Fanon manifolds. If you want to construct Keller-Einstein metric, then you are it boils down to solve a certain Monge-Pascal equation of the following type. Let's say this is a triple star. And it is well known that it's not always possible to solve that. Even if the class here is scalar, it depends on the geometry. And despite severe works, it's still widely open as a question. But the point is that there is a solution in the geometrical smooth sense, if and only if there is, so a smooth, if you like, solution, if and only if there is a finite energy solution. You still don't know what is a finite energy, but let's say it's a weak, you have a true honest solution if and only if you have a weak solution. So before stating our results, I first need to recall a few notions on big classes. That probably most of you already know, but let's say you don't. So first definition is, what is a big class? So a class is big if it contains a Keller current. So you have a positive closed current in the class, and this current is a priori singular, but it is bounded from below by a Keller form. So most of the definitions I will give here are essentially due to Domailly, and by comparison to the talk of this morning, when alpha is the first chain class of a line bundle, then of course, hopefully, alpha is big if and only if the underlying line bundle is big in the sense that we discussed this morning. So it has a lot of holomorphic sections when you take a power of it. The second definition I need is the notion of a metric with minimal singularities. They were discussed this morning in the talk of Berman. Let me recall the definition. So a current T in alpha has minimal singularity if the following happens. Let's say you fix a smooth representative of the class alpha, then T can be written like this, and if you take any other current S in the same class, which is positive, then the potential of S is more singular than the one of T. So this is up to an additive constant. And the simple but important observation of due to Domayi is that this kind of guy always exists. Namely, you can consider the following Strumov function. You take the supremum of all function V such that V is what I will call theta perisomonic, meaning that theta plus dBcV is positive. So in order for this to make sense, you want V to be slightly regular, upper semi-continuous and integral. And you normalize such function by asking for the sup to be equal to zero. So if you consider such a function V theta, then theta plus dBcV theta has minimal singularity. So in the talk, there are essentially two fundamental type of currents, those ones with minimal singularities and those ones with finite energy. And I will come to the second ones in a few minutes. Slightly less classical. I will denote by omega to the alpha, omega subscript alpha, the set of points where, let's say, V theta is locally bounded. And it follows again from a result of the Mayi. An approximation result of the Mayi that omega alpha contains a Sarytsky open set. Maybe I should give a simple example here. Imagine you have, let's say you consider the blow up of a manifold Y at some given point. And you start with an ample line bundle on Y, and that you pull back here. Then and of course this class is no longer ample, but it is big. And in this case, omega alpha is X. So any metric with minimal singularity will be actually bounded on X, globally bounded, but if you take a Keller current in the class alpha, it has to be singular on the exceptional divisor. There is a sort of competition when you are studying big classes. So you are big if you contain a Keller current. That's one nice object to consider, Keller currents within this class. But also you have those metric or current with minimal singularities, and you essentially cannot be both Keller and having minimal singularities unless the class is Keller. So if, let's say, at least for alpha less and big, then a Keller current does not have minimal singularity, unless the class was already Keller. for those who know a bit of the analysis that is behind the solution of such monomial equation, it means that you will have a lack of positivity somewhere if you want to be able to work with minimal current with minimal singularities. And a slightly modified example, if now rather than alpha you consider, say, alpha tilde, which is alpha plus the exceptional divisor, then in this case the omega alpha is the complement of the exceptional divisor. So any positive current within this new class here, alpha tilde, will have logarithmic singularities along E. So in a sense, what it tells you is that if you want to solve Monge-Ampère equations in big classes, you will have to work in some Zariski open set rather than on the whole manifold. So maybe I think I'm ready to state at least one result. Yeah? Let alpha be a big class. Let mu actually, yeah, something like this be a measure with density in LP, so as in Polozzi's result, and with a normalizing condition that the total mass of this measure is the volume of alpha, then the result is that there exists a unique T in alpha with minimal singularity such that T to the n is equal to mu, where it makes sense, namely in this omega alpha. So there is one thing that I haven't defined yet in this context. This is the volume of a big class. So this was partly done by Berman this morning. But I would like an analytic definition of the volume rather than the algebraic one that was recalled this morning. So let me recall that. The definition actually starts by the following lemma. Assume that you have two currents, positive currents, in the class alpha, with locally bounded potentials in some, let's say, in omega alpha. Then if F is more singular than T, meaning that the potential of S is bounded from above by that of T up to an additive constant, then the conclusion is that the mass of the Monge-Ampère measure of S on omega alpha is bounded from above by that of T. And the latter is finite. You can estimate in cohomology. And the proof, as you might imagine, it's a simple integration by parts. And I will skip it. In particular, if you take two currents with minimal singularities, then rather than having an inequality, you have an equality there. And this is the definition of the volume. So this is the analytic definition of the volume. And a remark that is actually a theorem that was mentioned this morning due to Bookson is that if alpha is actually the first chance class of a big line model, then the volume of alpha is the volume of L, which was this constant, recall this morning, that appears in the asymptotic dimension of holomorphic sections of L, of powers of L. So, the last thing I need to recall you on big classes is what is called the approximate Zariski decomposition. Namely, if you give yourself any small fixed epsilon, you can blow up the manifold X in such a way that the pullback of the big class alpha can be decomposed as follows, where this guy here is a Keller form, a Keller class, sorry, and this guy here is an effective R divisor that projects in the complement of omega alpha. And moreover, so the important point is that the volume of the Keller class beta epsilon is up to a small error, which is negative, the volume of alpha. So the strategy of the proof of solving this Monchamper equation in big classes is to use this approximate Zariski decomposition to blow up and to solve Monchamper equation associated to this guy, and then to project down and to see what happened. Just one word about the proof of this. This is again by some approximation results of the Mayi. Once you know the result of Bookson, of this analytic definition over here, that the volume of alpha is given as the total Monchamper mass of a current with minimal singularity. So you approximate T by some T epsilon in alpha, which has analytic singularity. And then you resolve the singularities of T epsilon, and you obtain such a situation. So this is a vague idea of how it works. So now I can finally, I will define you what is a solution of finite energy. Start to develop a sort of non-peripolar intersection theory. So, start once again with a big class, and I fix theta a smooth representative of alpha, and I also fix V theta, or maybe V theta is confusing, some V theta for some harmonic function with minimal singularities. And now let's consider any positive current T in alpha. The goal now is to associate to this T a non-peripolar the non-pluripolar measure that I will denote by this. The non-pluripolar Mongeau-Pair measure. So how to do that? Well, we proceed as follows. Consider phi j, which is the maximum of phi, the potential of t, and v minus j. So it turns out that the maximum of two theta parasomonic function is again theta parasomonic. So this is this space pH x theta. And moreover, since this guy here has minimal singularity, phi j has minimal singularity. And now there is a rather elementary lemma, but crucial one, that the sequence, following sequence, take the characteristic function of the set where phi is strictly bigger than this guy here. And now you take the Mongeau-Pair measure of phi j. And you look at that essentially in omega alpha, where it makes sense. Then this sequence is increasing. This is an increasing sequence of positive Borel measures. With mass, with total mass, bounded from above by the volume of the class. So you can pass to the limit. And define the non-pluripolar Mongeau-Pair measure of t as being the limit, the increasing limit of those measures. I will denote them by mu j, say. And actually the proof is rather elementary. It's elementary but tricky. So it's a tricky game, a game where there is one rule. And the rule has been observed by Bedford and Taylor in the late 80s. Namely, if you look at the set where u is strictly bigger than v, u and v being theta parasomonic function, and if you cook up the Mongeau-Pair of the maximum of those two guys, then you obtain the Mongeau-Pair of u. That's the one and only one rule of this game.
So if alpha's up, or alpha's big mass, is Tn in the same class as alpha n?
Once again?
If alpha were big mass, bigger mass, then would Tn be the same?
Yes. And so this is actually a quite easy observation if the function were continuous. And the problem is that this set is not open, so you need to do something. And roughly speaking, the observation of Bedford and Taylor is that those Mongeau-Pair guys are making Mongeau-Pair of a maximum is actually a local operation in the purifying topology of parasomonic functions. So that's the key to this kind of property. So finally, you will get the definition of finite energy class. So T, I will denote it by this, has finite energy if the mass of this non-pluripolar Mongeau-Pair of T is the volume of alpha. So what happens is that in the process of doing so, you may well have lost Mongeant-Pair mass. If you don't, then you're said to have a finite energy. So it's pretty clear from the definition that those guys are the right one to understand the volume of a given class, no? Let me perhaps give some example, because up to now it's extremely formal. So first, to help with the intuition, perhaps in dimension one, what is this? So E of alpha, belonging to alpha is simply prescribing the total mass of the measure that you're looking at. So the E of alpha is a set of positive measures with fixed mass, and such that, let me denote it by mu maybe, such that mu give no mass to polar set. Having finite energy, in this sense, in dimension one, simply means that you are not putting mass to polar set. So it's slightly more general than the classical Dirichlet finite energy condition that would require that the potential is in L2. It's weaker than that. It's more general than that. And as an illustration, in any dimension, if you start with any current in alpha, but you can always shift by an additive constant. So let me assume that phi is bounded from above by a guy with minimal singularity minus one. That's just for the to make computation easier. Then you can consider the following guy, phi epsilon, which is v theta minus phi plus v theta to the power epsilon, where epsilon is in between 0 and 1. And a simple computation tells you that this guy, thanks to such normalization, is again theta paratonic. It's an easy computation. And moreover, the important fact here is that T epsilon, so observe maybe that phi 0 is V theta minus 1, and phi 1 is the function you started with. So it's a way of interpolating in between the function with minimal singularities and the function you are starting with. And then T epsilon, which is theta plus ddc phi epsilon, has finite energy as soon as epsilon is strictly less than 1. So in other words, if you just slightly attenuate the singularities of phi, then you enter the world of finite energy. In particular, it's quite easy already in dimension 1 to make computation like this to realize that this guy rarely has a gradient in L2. I think I'm ready to state the second result, which in a sense is actually the first one. Oh no. One more remark before that. This is that the operator T goes to non-pluripolar Mongeant-Pair of T. This guy is continuous along decreasing sequences of potentials. If and only if T has finite energy. So this is one further justification of looking at this class. In a sense, it says that this Mongeant-Pair non-pluripolar thing is well defined if and only if you are in the finite energy class. Okay. Erase that one. Now the second important result about the resolution of double star or flat Poisson pair equation in big classes is the following. Again, in the same collaboration. So again, alpha is a fixed big class, and you fix a positive measure, normalized, so that its total mass is the volume of alpha. Then there exists, and if it exists, it is unique, a positive current with finite energy in alpha, such that T to the n is mu, if and only if mu does not charge pluripolar sets. So this result was obtained for Keller classes in a previous work of mine with Sapiayi, and it actually also worked in this context of big classes. And that's the strategy actually of the proof of the first theorem. Well, I shouldn't put it that way, but so let's say that theorem 1 follows from theorem 2 plus an infinity a priori estimate. In the style of Golgi. Maybe I will make a further second remark that theorem 1 plus further a priori estimate of higher order if mu says smooth or more regular will imply higher order regularity of the solution of T, but only in, let's say, omega hat alpha, which is called traditionally the ample locus of the big class. So it's something, some open, variously open set, which is, in general, slightly smaller than the omega alpha I was defining earlier. So I will try now to give you just a few hints about the proof of theorem 1. But before that, I realized I forgot to indicate a crucial stability property of the finite energy class. And this is really what makes the result work. Imagine that you have a sequence, approximating sequence of positive currents in alpha. They don't have finite energy. They won't have finite energy. You will realize that in a few minutes. But they have almost finite energy, meaning that the mass, the total mass of the non-pluripolar measure of the TJ increases towards the volume of alpha. Assume you have that, and a control on what we call the weighted Monge Ampère mesh. Assume you have a weight, chi, a convex increasing function, which is minus infinity at minus infinity, and such that the soup over j of the integral in omega alpha of the following quantities this soup is finite. And let's say by a weak argument, weak star argument, that this sequence converges towards some positive current t in alpha, then the conclusion is that the limit has finite energy. So it's a bit sort of obscure condition, but let me show you, give you a sketch of proof of theorem 1 where you will see how this kind of condition appears. So as I mentioned earlier, I start with this approximate Zariski decomposition. So I blow up and consider the decomposition of the pullback of my class, my big class alpha, as beta epsilon plus e epsilon. And this one here is scalar with volume almost equal to the volume of alpha. Now I had my measure mu here, living here. I can pull it back to x epsilon. So let me define mu epsilon, which is the pullback of mu. But I need to adjust a little bit. I mean, the total mass of mu epsilon is the volume of alpha, and the class I would like to consider has a slightly smaller volume. So I multiply by some constant that will go to 1 as epsilon shrink to 0. And I solve. So this is thanks to my previous result with Delyayi, I solve f epsilon to the n equals mu epsilon on x epsilon, where f epsilon has finite energy with respect to the Keller class beta epsilon. Now I project down. So consider the epsilon. So this is the projection of S epsilon, but S epsilon lives in beta epsilon. It's not in the right class, so I add this effective divisor E epsilon. And as a result, this guy here lives in alpha. And it does not have finite energy because of this term that I added. So here you have logarithmic singularities at infinity in omega alpha, if you like. But the non-pluripolar Monge-Ampère measure of the epsilon, which, by the way, I should have told this, is well defined for any current. So that's sort of an important point here. Huh? It is defined for any current. And this is, of course, phi epsilon times mu. So it goes to mu as epsilon goes to zero. And now let's check that such analytic control is satisfied here. What you want to look at is the integral of minus chi of, so let's write the epsilon, which is theta plus dvt the epsilon. And you want to control this. But by construction, the non-pluripolar Monge-Ampère measure of the epsilon is the epsilon times this. C epsilon goes to 1, so let's say it's less than 2. And the property that mu does not charge per placette is used here to say that if you take a weight, so you think probably that convex means that it has a fast growth, but you look at that at minus infinity. There are many minus signs, so actually it has slow growth at minus infinity. And so a result, a rather elementary result, is that if you attenuate, thanks to this weight chi, sufficiently the possible singularities of those guys, then you've got uniform integrability of such a family as soon as it is compact. And so here arises the thing I should have said earlier, namely that of course you have a family of solution if you change phi epsilon adding a constant. So you need to ask for some normalization in order to make this family compact or pre-compact. And what you ask for is that phi epsilon minus some fixed metric with minimal singularity, the sup of this difference is zero. And if you do that, then you have a pre-compact family in L1, and you get uniform integrability. Therefore, this analytic condition is satisfied. And the current key that you've got here, that you've constructed here, as a weak limit, any weak limit, any cluster point of the epsilon, will have finite energy. And there are little more effort, but rather standard ones to finish and saying that this is indeed the solution of your Mongeon-Pair equation. It turns out to be rather easy to finish at this stage. The difficult part somehow is to make sure that you have a finite energy guy. Thank you.